Okay, I'm going to call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that the time is currently 1:39 p.m. on April 15th, 2026. And let's see here. Present today, we have Representative Stapp, Representative Moore, Representative Bynum, Co-Chair Shragi, Co-Chair Josephson, Representative Galvin, Representative Tomaszewski, Representative Hannon, myself, Co-Chair Foster. And just a reminder, folks can mute their cell phones. We have on the agenda two items today, and that is House Bill 96. That's the Home Care Employment Standards Advisory Board by Representative Prox. We also, let's see, we heard this bill last year briefly, so we will get a detailed recap of the bill. We're going to take public testimony, and we will review the fiscal notes. Then we're going to hear an introduction of Senate Bill 86. And that is the Money Transmission and Virtual Currency Bill by Senator Keel. For that bill, we'll take public testimony and review the fiscal notes. So with that, starting off with House Bill 96, Home Care Employment Standards Advisory Board, Representative Prax, if you and your staff, Mr. Riley Nye, could please come to the table. And we also have Alexis Rodich, the director of the Alaska and Montana SEIU, Local 775. You're welcome to the table as well. And if you could go ahead and put yourself on the record, Representative Prox, and start us off with the bill. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair and members of the Finance Committee. For the record, this is Representative Mike Prox. I represent House District 33, the Moose Creek, North Pole, and East Badger Road areas. I'm joined by my aide, Riley Nye, and Alexis Rodich of the Alaska Caregivers Local 775, who will be, Alexis will be providing invited testimony and answering technical questions and correcting me when I'm wrong. So, HB 96 was drafted in response to regulations proposed by the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services in 2024 to establish a Home Care Employment Standards Advisory Board to address the growing shortage of people who are willing and able to assist people who require help performing the tasks of daily living or habilitation. Helping people with the tasks of daily living requires compassionate people of high integrity and sufficient training to ensure their clients and their own safety. The in-home care industry has developed informally over the years. In-home care is not necessarily considered medical care for purposes of Medicare or Medicaid or other insurance program, but in-home care providers are professionals in a very real sense of the term. So it is time to establish standards to recognize these skills, the skills they have, and compensate them properly for the services they provide. Hopefully this will attract more people to enter the profession. As from the perspective of the state Medicaid program, caring for those who simply need assistance with the tasks of daily living or habilitation in their own home generally is considerably less expensive than caring for them in an assisted living facility or higher level care facility such as a nursing home. More importantly, people prefer to be cared for in their own home for as long as possible rather than being moved to unfamiliar surroundings. So that is kind of the general purpose behind House Bill 96. And now, if you wish, Riley can go through the sectional, bill sectional.
Okay, Mr. Nye, if you could put yourself on the record. Before we do, actually, I'm sorry, I just want to recognize that we also have with us Representative Allard and Mr. Nye.
For the record, Riley Nye, staff to Representative Prox, and thank you, House Finance Committee members, for hearing this bill today. Section 1 amends AS4429 by adding new sections to it and various aspects of the Home Care Employment Standards Advisory Board. Home Care Section 4429-900, Home Care Employment Standards Advisory Board. This section is added to establish the Advisory Board on Home Care Employment Standards in Alaska. Section 4429-905 is composition of the board. This section elaborates on the composition of the board, which will consist of a chair, 6 voting, and 4 non-voting members. This section clarifies how many members should be sought from each represented group or institution. Their members will be appointed by the Commissioner of Health after solicitation of applications. Thus, Commissioner of Health or Commissioner's designee, non-voting, unless in the event of a tie, Commissioner of Labor and Workforce Development or the Commissioner's designee, non-voting, 2 members representing covered providers with variance in terms of size, services provided, and geographical location. That's a voting member. 2 members who represent direct care workers. That's a voting member. 1 member who is an enrollee or representative of enrollees receiving covered services. That's a voting member. 1 member who represents the Office of Rate Review. That's a voting member. A representative of the Alaska Commission on Aging or another organization that represents seniors in the state. That's a non-voting member. A representative of the Governor's Council on Disabilities and Special Education, another organization that represents people with disabilities in the state. It's a non-voting member. Section 4429-910 is Terms of Office, Vacancies, Removal. This section explains how the members of the board appointed in AS4429-905, subsection 3, will serve and establish how long they shall serve, options for reappointment, and how vacancies will be filled. Section 4429-915 is Meetings. This section establishes the duty of the chair to call for meetings of the board with regularity and as needed. It also establishes that the board should meet at least 3 times each year and hold additional meetings as often as necessary to accomplish its duties.
Mr. Nye?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sorry. And if you could just maybe hit the high points. I don't know that we need to read through publication reports, definitions, just the change in codified law, some of the more detailed stuff. Maybe just the high points I think are fine.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The board is a non-compensated board, but they will receive per diem and expenses reimbursement. The powers and duties of the board, this section establishes the powers and duties of the board, including advising and consulting the Department on Medical Assistance Program payment rates for covered services and payment rate adequacy of covered services, as well as investigating employment issues and concerns, including wages, working conditions, and workforce development, and making recommendations. There's going to be a biennial report. This section requires the board to submit a written report biennially to the commissioner. The commissioner is mandated to review with the aim of accepting or rejecting findings and recommendations and to give guidance and way forward depending on circumstances. And lastly, I would note the publication of reports from Section 4429-940. This section mandates the publication of the reports on July 1st each year, and the reports must be publicly accessible, and it elaborates on what must be included in those reports. And with the co-chair's permission, we would transfer on to our invited testimony.
Great. That's perfect. Thank you very much. Let's see. I was hoping to hold off on questions till we got through the presentations, as they might be questions might be answered. But if you have clarifying questions, maybe, I guess, on some of the things we've talked about. I think first I saw Representative Hannon, then Representative Allard. Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Foster, because I have a couple questions on the composition of the board, because the way the terms are used, I'm not sure I understand them, and I would like to understand them before we get to details about how that board functions. So if I may, one is 2 members representing covered providers. So I assume the care workers union is one of those, if that's what it means. So is there more than one union that represents care providers, or
right.
Who are those folks?
Yep. Through the chair.
Representative Abrox.
Yes. The covered care providers refers to the agencies that then employ the care providers.
Okay.
And there's one in, let's see, specifically provided personal care services, and the other that provides habilitation services.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Can I continue? Two members who represent direct care workers. So that's the unions.
That's the unions.
And is follow up. Is there more than one union currently representing care providers? Are there two unions, one for personal care and one for medical care?
Would that be, if you could put yourself on the record?
Sure. This is Alexis Rodich, and through the chair, there is currently only one union, I believe, that's providing, that's representing direct care workers. However, the position, the idea is that there's more than one position, so there could be someone else representing direct care workers. Maybe that's someone else that is involved with DSPs or other folks. Our membership, the Alaska Caregivers Union, has both DSPs and PCAs.
Okay. And follow up on that?
Representative Pannon?
Are there people providing these services that are not members of a union, and would they have the opportunity to have a vote at the board?
Ms. Rodich?
Absolutely, and through the chair, absolutely. These are appointed positions, not guaranteed positions. So there are standards written into this that indicate that a union could be one of the representatives, or should be, but not the only representative. So I suppose the governor or whoever is doing the appointing, the commissioner, can determine who the other person is.
Okay, some follow-up.
Representative Hammond.
One member who is an enrollee or representative of an enrollee. So I am assuming that means a client or a client's representative. And so that's where I'm like a representative of a client. So if I'm a guardian of someone who is a recipient, it could be the guardian. Is that what that means?
Ms. Rodich, yes. Or Representative Prox?
Yes, that is my understanding. We also have Jordan Grant, sorry. Division of Senior and Disability Services online. Perhaps they could address that more specifically.
Mr. Jordan Grant, I see you're calling in from Anchorage. If you could put yourself on the record, just state your name and your title.
Hi, my name is Jordan Grant. I'm the Policy Unit Manager for the Division of Senior and Disability Services, and I'm so sorry. Our audio is not great. Would you mind repeating the question, please?
Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. I was asking some questions under the composition of the board, and one of them is a member who is an enrollee or a representative of an enrollee, and I'm just trying to understand who that person is. Is that potentially a guardian of a beneficiary who's receiving services, or what is a representative of an enrollee?
Ms. Grant.
Thank you so much. Again, my name is Jordan Grant, Policy Unit Manager for the Division of Senior and Disability Services. And through the chair, I believe that speaks to someone who is receiving one of the covered services, or someone who is a legal decision maker for someone who is receiving one of the covered services.
Right. Okay. And then my last one is one member who represents the Office of Rate Receive. And I have never heard that phrase before. So Representative Prox, what's the Office of Rate Receive? Is that a state agency or?
No, I think that is a misspelling.
Representative Prox? Maybe should it be Rate Review?
Rate Review, I believe. Yes. No. There's one, the ones we've listed. Then we have
voting member
for rate review. Yes. A voting member who represents the office within the department with responsibility for rate review, Department of Health.
Review, maybe.
Yeah.
Okay. It's just a typo.
Okay. So then a question following up on that. So the department has a non-voting member from the office of the commissioner.
Right.
And then, but it does have a voting member from the Office of Rate Review.
Right.
And that person would then be a staff person at the Department of Health who serves in the Office of Rate Review. Okay. Thank you.
Prox, is that correct?
That is correct. Sorry.
Through the chair. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Also would like to note that we have with us Representative Jimmy. And I think we're going to go to Representative Allard, and then we're going to, unless this is a question on composition, board composition, which we're kind of on this.
I can wait.
Okay. Representative Ellard?
Yeah. It's a little bit on the fiscal note side, just real quick, though, maybe, unless you want me to wait.
Let's see. We haven't gotten to the fiscal note yet. Maybe if we could hold off on that. Okay, so I've got in the queue Galvin as well as Ellard for the fiscal note. Let's see. So with that, I think next up we've got Ms. Rodich with your invited testimony.
Thank you. And through the chair, my name is Alexis Rodich. I am the director of Alaska and Montana for the Alaska Caregivers Union, SEIU 775. And thank you all members of the committee for the opportunity to be here today to talk about HB 96. Our union represents more than 60,000 direct care workers in Washington, Montana, and Alaska. And we are deeply committed to a strong and sustainable system of long-term services and supports in Alaska. And we believe that this bill is an important means to that end. As many of you know, our state has been experiencing a massive demographic shift that is driving up demand for care and for higher skilled care in particular. Over the last decade, Alaska has had one of the fastest growing senior populations per capita in the country, a trend that is expected to continue over the next decade. Older Alaskans and Alaskans with disabilities are living longer, which is great. However, with age comes higher acuity and more complex care needs. Many of the caregivers that we work with, for example, have children with developmental disabilities who are living far longer than generations before. And they ask, what happens if I'm no longer able to provide care for my child? Who's going to be the qualified caregiver to provide care for them? Similarly, Alzheimer's and other dementias are also on the rise, which creates higher demand for paid and unpaid care services. Given these demographic changes, it is no surprise that the Department of Labor and Workforce Development predicts that home care will be one of the fastest growing and in-demand occupations in the state. And yet at the same time, the number of potential caregivers, that is working adults age 18 to 64, is in decline, going from 15 in 2008 to just 7 in 2030. And the shortage is even more stark in rural and remote areas of our state. A higher concentration of older Alaskans live in Southeast Alaska and on the peninsula than any other parts of the state. They have built lives and families, and they don't want to have to move to Anchorage or out of state in order to get the care they need as they age. And I know that nobody in this room wants them to have to do that either. And we certainly don't want to force people to move into institutional or congregate care settings. These settings can cost the state hundreds of thousands of dollars more per person per year. And the workforce crisis will only get worse and far more costly for the state unless we start taking the steps now to ensure that we have a well-trained, professional direct care workforce in our state. So HB 96 helps in two ways. First, it helps make sure that the state is maximizing the Medicaid rate for personal care services by creating what we might informally call a labor rate for personal care services. And that is a percent of the Medicaid rate that agencies receive for PCA services that must go to the pay and benefits of direct care workers. In this case, we're looking at 70% to begin with and then up to 80% by 2029. In a state like Alaska, where almost all personal care services are provided through a consumer or client-directed agency with choice model, far less of the Medicaid rate needs to go to agency overhead because the agency has far fewer responsibilities than a traditional agency model. Under our model, it is the consumer, the client, not the agency that's responsible for recruitment, for scheduling, for training, for managing, for hiring. And so it's fair that a substantial amount of the rate in this case should go to the individuals that are actually providing the care services. In this case, so like I said, 70% initially and 80% by 2029. HB 96 would also create much more transparency around how this Medicaid personal care rate is being used. Over the past few years, as I know you've all heard, caregiver after caregiver have flown to Juneau and met with many of you guys and other members of this body. They've called in to public testimony, and they have shared multiple times how the low Medicaid rate keeps their own pay low and makes it impossible for them to make ends meet while doing this job. So they're forced to pick up several extra jobs or juggle bills, go into debt, or leave this profession altogether. This body listened and has responded with multiple rate increases, two of which expressed the legislative intent that some of the rate go to caregiver pay and benefits. And while some caregivers, like those that are in a union, were able to see pay increases as much as $2 to $4 an hour, which is a big relief if you've only been making $16 an hour, but many, many more did not. And really, no one knows how the agencies are used the recent rate increases, nor how much actually went to pay and benefits as the legislature intended, because this information does not seem to be collected or analyzed. This was echoed in the findings of a comprehensive study commissioned by the Department of Health and conducted by Guidehouse. This study found that indirect costs, that is the administrative overhead, program support, and other non-direct care costs, made up a larger share of the total of use of the Medicaid rate in Alaska than is typical for other states, even if you account for the higher general cost of living and operational costs here in the state. And notably, the report didn't find a justifiable reason for the disproportionate share going to indirect costs other than possible business inefficiency. So more transparency, such as the reporting requirements in this bill, will not only help enforce the 70%, later 80% labor rate, but it also gives the department and the Office of Rate Review, as well as the legislature, much more transparency on how to assess how the rate is actually being used. The second way that HB 96 strengthens the long-term care workforce is that it creates a workforce standard advisory board. This board, modeled in part after similar entities in Nevada and Washington, brings the stakeholders most impacted by the care system, providers, caregivers, clients, and the Department of Health together to identify and plan for longer-term workforce needs, assess whether the rates are adequate to meet those needs, and make rate recommendations to the Department of Health as part of the department's rate-setting process. You know, late summer and early fall of every year, we start meeting with caregivers that we represent from around the state, and we talk about what should be prioritized in the upcoming legislative session. And every year, the same topics come up. They talk about training or the possibility someday of getting health insurance. They talk a lot about their clients not getting the hours that they need. And things like these take time. Initiatives like these take time. They require broad input, and they require future planning. A board like the one proposed in this bill creates a vehicle for these groups of stakeholders, each of whom have a unique and invaluable expertise on the care system, to work together to identify priorities, recommend solutions, and assess whether we are adequately resourced or we need to plan ahead. The demographic changes that I referenced earlier are already underway, and the caregiver shortage is sorely felt. We have heard wrenching stories of caregivers and their clients needing to move to Anchorage in order to get their care needs met, or someone having to quit their job and provide unpaid care to a loved one because that loved one might otherwise go without. HB 96 is an opportunity for us to make a different choice for Alaska, one that's far less costly for the state in the long term, and one that Alaskans who will need care now or down the road. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. I've got three people on the public testimony list, so I want to make sure that we're not keeping them. So I'm going to open public testimony on HB 96. And if folks would like to provide public testimony, if you're watching online, you can submit that to house.finance@akleg.gov. Again, that's house.finance@akleg.gov. So I've got David Sutton, Teresa Heitman, and Abigail Tekek online. Mr. David Sutton, if you could put yourself on the record, looks like you're calling in from Anchorage, your name and your affiliation.
Who is that taking calls?
If you could put your name and affiliation on the record, Mr. Sutton.
My name is David Sutton, and I'm a caregiver with Consumer Direct.
Okay, go ahead.
I was told to call in today because you're deciding on the wages, and I know that personally in my experience, it really helped. I had just lost a family member. I took care of my dad in his home for 14 years. The only goal being to keep him in his home, and I had to learn a lot of stuff. He wasn't mobile. Anyways, I got a lot of experience in a new career. At the beginning of it, I didn't have any wages coming in to support keeping him in the house. So we had to get rid of the caregivers coming in so that I took over that job myself so we could still keep them in the home. And at first, it wasn't that good of a rate, but I was just happy to be able to still keep them in his home. The last time, though, that they did the wage increases, it finally made it a little bit easier because a year and a half, maybe 2 years, I had to seek a nighttime job so that I could make ends meet, which means getting him in bed, leaving him home alone just so that I could go out and earn some wages to keep him in that house that we're trying to care for him. And like I said, this finally, after 14 years, he did pass away on March 30th. So it does really, really help to meet those goals, to have those wages. And we are doing the work. And it would give us a chance, hopefully, to get more people into the careers. I know that you guys offer in the whole program of paying in-home caregivers, especially those that are full-time, but we only get paid for the hours that we're working. The rest of it is all volunteer. And so I was pretty much upset, and we couldn't get respite workers to come in for the 2 weeks a year to give me a break. They allowed for 10 hours a week, which we couldn't even get somebody for that. So I didn't get a break. I was at my post for those years, not even being able to get out. So it is important. And just getting respite workers, especially with gas prices, a lot of them, they didn't want to come up. It's, you know, far away from if they have to drive. That's an added expense just for them to go work for a few hours at somebody's home. And they're not just glorified babysitters. I mean, they're taking care of patients. In some cases, they're their only contact to the outside world. And we would like to have higher wages to not only get more people in, but to make sure that they're quality people. So I'm encouraging you definitely to vote on the increases for caregivers. And that's all my testimony.
Thank you very much, Mr. Sutton. And with that, the next person we have is Ms. Teresa Heitman calling in from Ketchikan. If you can state your name and your affiliation, who you're with.
Oh, hello. My name is Teresa Heitman, and I was born and raised in Alaska, 67 years, and I started out in Fairbanks attending nursing school, and then went to Anchorage attending nursing school, and worked in Sitka in the hospital, and then I ended up 33 years, my last 33 years in Ketchikan, frequent visits to Fairbanks to help my family. I have a 91-year-old mother who is going through a lot of health crisis, and she does not have an in-home caregiver, so I have to go help her for free, which caused me not to make money. So I had to leave her just 2 days ago in the hospital so I could return to my caregiving job that I have in Ketchikan so I can support myself. And so my testimony is pretty repetitive of what has already been shared. I care for a disabled young adult while her mother goes and works at another caregiving job for another disabled family member of hers. And my point is that I'm very grateful for the union that has recently stepped up, because if it wasn't for the union, I would not be making comparable wages to even survive either. And so I wrote a big speech out, but I was afraid I wasn't going to be able to say everything I have to say. But it sounds like the people that went before me pretty much covered everything. As caregivers, we do need the funding available so that we can, first of all, our clients do not get a lot of the services that they need. They're underfunded for their services, and some of my clients have a lot of needs that we're not getting paid to do it. We have to do it for free because they still, like we've spoken before, they can't get out of the house and do the things themselves. And so the caregivers have to step up up in notches, and we have to spend our own money on gas and our time, and it can make it really stressful for us, because we all have our own families and our own lives we have to live too, and we're not trying to complain, we're not whining, we're the ones that chose this job, and we're grateful for the job, we're grateful to have the opportunity. I love my clients, and I love helping them, but at times, it's like that young man just spoke, it's very demanding and overwhelming, and now I'm down to torn between my being a caregiver for my clients, being helping my family with my mother, and like I said, he doesn't have a caregiver right now, but we're not sure if we're going to have to put her in an institution or if we can get some caregiving services for her, because she, like the experience a couple of days ago, she's not going to be able to be at home on her own anymore. So, yes, I really do appreciate all of it that you all are considering with the funding and the Medicaid and the caregiving organizations, and I just wanted to say I am very grateful to have this opportunity to speak, because As I attended two town hall meetings with Scott Kawasaki and several of his representatives from Fairbanks, which are, I think, on your committee right now, and they were very sympathetic, realizing that there's many more people living longer, especially the elderly, and many of them could stay in their homes if they were able to have caregivers that could provide, you know, much of the things that they can't do. I mean, as long as they have somebody helping them with their daily tasks and making sure they have food, a lot of times they can maintain themselves. It saves them having to be, like you mentioned, institutionalized. And we also bring things to the table that other people can't. And sometimes the family just can't do it anymore. They're exhausted and they really need us. So I just wanted to let you know I really appreciate you all considering this this bill. And it's something I've been helping fight for quite a few years too. And I'm thankful and excited to hear that there's progress going forward with this. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ms. Heitman. We've got a question or comment from Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Ms. Heitman, thank you for calling in and testifying. I also want to thank you for taking time to come to Juneau to advocate for this cause and meeting with all of us. So thank you very much for your time today.
Okay.
Well, I feel grateful to be able to have that opportunity. So thanking everybody that made that possible, too. And thank you, Jeremy. I appreciate you also.
Representative Stout.
Through the chair, Teresa, it's always good to see you, whether I'm in Fairbanks at my local neighborhood store or here in Juneau, and I haven't seen you in Ketchikan yet, but I hope to one day when I get down there. So thanks for your testimony.
Okay.
That Will talking to me? The audio is not very good. I think that was that Will that just spoke up.
It was me. Yes.
Representative Stapp. That was Representative Stapp, Ms. Heitman. Thank you so much.
I love you, too. He's my favorite. He's my mom's representative, but he's my buddy, too. I love him.
Thank you very much. And with that, we've lastly got Ms. Abigail Tekek calling in from Shaktulik. If you can state your name and your affiliation.
Good afternoon. My name is Abigail Tekek. My Inupiaq name is Jugaatun, given by a respected elder. I am here today in speaking for elders and also those who have disabilities that cannot speak for themselves. As I am a caregiver, I've been a caregiver for going on 3 years now. There are challenges, and one of the challenges is not enough hours that I am able to put in with my clients each day. When I work with the elders, it's like having to do 12 minutes of washing dishes, 12 minutes of, because I work 2 hours with elders. It's like doing 12 minutes of cooking, 12 minutes of doing dishes, sweeping and mopping their floor, changing their bedding, feeding them. And that's how I see it. And it's daily task working for elders and those with disabilities. I feel like I need more time as a caregiver with them, especially the ones with the disability that can't walk or talk or do anything for themselves. One, very few people are able to step away from the paid work to care for these elders, and not enough. And elders that want to, that are still in their right mind, that are early onset with dementia, they're scared to leave their hometown, and they want to live in their homes. And here in the small villages, we don't have that elder facility to keep them in their village. Also, I would like to talk about the hours that I get and the pay that I get. I'm the only one working in my home. I'm the only one that provides the income to pay for bills and to buy food. Nowadays, in the store, the food is expensive, and so I'm not able to get the needs that we need in our home. I would greatly ask for support for HB 96 so that caregivers, like as I, can be paid fairly for our work, so that we can have a seat at the table to help make the system keep our elders safe at home and those with disabilities. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much, Ms. Tekak, for both your testimony as well as your coming down to Juneau. We met with you recently. I don't see any questions. So with that, I'm going to close public testimony for House Bill 96. And just a reminder that if folks would like to submit written testimony, they can do so by emailing us at house.finance@akleg.gov. Just one more check here. Is there anyone else in the room or online who would like to testify in case I need to open it back up? I don't see anybody. So with that, just wanted to double check. We do have one last item. It'll be quick, and that is just to review the fiscal note. And we should have Nicole Wary-Tegeban from Administrative Operations Manager for Senior and Disability Services. If you could walk us through the fiscal note and also confirm your control code at the bottom right of the fiscal note.
Hi. Yes. Nicole Wary-Tegeban, for the record, Administrative Operations Manager for Senior and Disability Services. And I'm sorry, can you repeat that again? Sorry, there's like a lot of static on this. Do you need me to repeat or confirm the control code on the bottom?
Yes, we have YXPZD. Just want to make sure that's what you have.
That is correct.
Okay, if you could walk us through the fiscal notes.
Yep. So this is for HB 96, and the fiscal note has an FY27 one additional position to help with the facilitation of the additional reporting requirements. And then in year 28 through 32, we have a secondary position again to assist with the collection of data and reporting that is required for this fiscal note. And the federal government is pulling back from non-essential services and increasing the scrutiny of costs. And so the department is elected to update the fiscal note rather than assuming the federal government would pay a portion of the cost for this particular board. And since they're actively working to rescind or delay, and then we expect more information in the months to come. But unfortunately, we had to change the fiscal note from a 50-50 match to a 100% general fund at this time. Are there any other questions?
We've got a question on the fiscal note from Representative Allard.
Thank you. Thank you for being here today through the co-chair. So a couple of my questions are, we have Alaska Board of Nursing, Alaska Commission of Aging, Department of Health. We do have your senior and disability, I guess, resource center. And then we have personal care services under the Department of Health. My concern is we have all these departments, all these boards. Are you telling me under Department of Health, we don't have a vacancy for a health program manager?
Ms. Where are you, Tegaband?
Again, for the record, Nicole Worry, Senior in Disability Services Operations Manager. I just need a clarification of the question. Are you asking if we have at the department level, we have an additional health program manager that is vacant?
Do we have, yes, and I apologize. Do we have two health program manager vacant positions? And if not, I know we have vacant positions in the health department. I'm not really sure why we need to reinvent the wheel instead of just reallocating and filling these particular positions for this job. I'm concerned that we have 96 boards and commissions, and then we're going to be spending an additional $370,000 to do another one.
Is it Wary? I've got on my iPad here Ms. Wary, but on my paperwork I have Wary Tegaban. Which do you prefer?
I would prefer Wary, please.
Did you say Wary?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Yes, if you could maybe address the question.
Yep. I would need to get back to you on if there are vacant positions that could be filled.
Okay. Can I just do...
Representative Allard?
No, I'm fine. Thank you.
Okay. Okay, I think that takes us through all of the items boxes to check off. And so we're going to go to questions. And Representative Galvin, thanks for your patience.
No problem. Thank you so much, Co-Chair Foster. Through the chair, I think this may be a question for the sponsor of the bill, but perhaps... I think that there may be an opportunity for a link back to your slides. So my understanding is the key goal is to find some way to organize workers in a way that, of course, keeps elders safe and at home, but also is looking after workforce conditions, workflow, wages, rates, accountability to patients, et cetera, is what I've heard. And my question is, and pardon me for not knowing this already, but I'm looking, when I read standards, I thought of like standards of care. I thought of what would be the gold standard for someone who is doing this sort of homework. Home health care. And so I wondered if there was any, is it a different body that would look at the training or the efficacy or whatever it is that is the services that are being offered, or does this body also look at that? And with that in mind, the question is, had you considered things like a geriatric specialist or someone who is an expert or training, able to train in respite or palliative care, just somebody who can look at all of the covered services and ensure that there is an expert, if you will, on the board, if that is the right body for this. And I'm not sure, so I would be okay if you said you're climbing up the wrong tree.
Representative Prox.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. For the record, this is Representative Mike Prox, and I don't know if we're on the right tree, but we're in the right forest.
Okay, yeah. Close.
I think that it is going to take some time and some work to determine the gold standard. I suppose I don't know, what is the gold standard, high standard for a nurse practitioner or something like that. But typically that probably wouldn't be provided at home, but who knows? Maybe somebody wants to get into that and they just need to get in and set different standards, really, because sometimes it's relatively, well, the tasks of daily living, managing medications. One lady said she's doing dishes, taking care of the house, et cetera, helping people into and out of a bed or a wheelchair. There's quite a variety as I see it. And I think that has to be defined and kind of segmented somehow to really figure this out. But I think that's the point of the board.
follow-up?
Representative Galvin.
Thank you. So with that in mind, I did read through the bill, and I guess I didn't see the language that said to articulate the breadth of services. I think that there is a wide breadth of services. I have friends who are doing this home care, and I really appreciate how much work it is, and also how there, in some cases, there may be some need for an understanding of very complex medication, for example, and understanding of how to help somebody in the bathroom and all of these different pieces. And so I just wanted to make sure that if there was some space for that, and if it's important to have someone who knows and understands that well, and I'm sure workers would, but I'm not sure if they would be the expert on that. But I do see that there's a worker who's on this board, a couple of them, and also those who would be receiving the care. Mm-hmm. So that makes sense too. And sometimes in my mind, because I've dealt with my elders too, I learned a lot from hearing from the palliative care provider. And so I just wanted to make sure that if that was something that should be in this bill, that maybe there would be consideration of space for that.
Reps, Mr. Nye.
Through the chair. Thank you, Mr. Co-chair. Through the chair to Representative Galvin. On page 3, starting on line 12, powers and duties of the board, mm-hmm. It says the board shall investigate matters related to wages, working conditions, and workforce adequacy of workers providing covered services in the state, including subsection D on line 26, which is the adequacy and enforcement of training requirements. So they will be reviewing the adequacy and enforcement of training requirements.
Representative Prox.
Thank you, Mr. Co-chair. Might be worthwhile to hear from the department what they kind of how they envision this developing.
And who would you like to speak to?
Is it I lost
would that be
my
Nicole
note.
Nicole Wary?
No, I think
the fiscal person though.
No,
Jordan Grants.
Yep.
Okay, Ms. Jordan Grants.
Hi, for the record, Jordan Grant, Policy Unit Manager for the Division of Senior and Disability Services. I believe the question is pertaining to the adequacy of enforcement and training requirements. Is that correct?
Mr. Representative Prox.
Well, I think we're looking for more information on the direction it might take the standards and the definitions of the various tasks and skills.
If I might,
sure. Again, through the chair, this is Jordan Grant, Policy Unit Manager for the Division of Senior and Disability Services. I'm not sure I can speak to exactly what direction the board would choose to respond or look into those issues. I can tell you that the state and federal government, there are regulations in effect that dictate the sort of training and service standards that are already in existence. So perhaps the board would contemplate whether those standards are being effectively met by agencies. I think the bill gives a lot of latitude for what that could mean.
Representative Galvin.
Sure. Follow up would be, thank you. I'm looking at line 17 of page 3, talking about workforce adequacy of workers providing covered services in the state. And I guess for me, the question would be the covered services piece. Are we, you know, in some way, I imagine the board will be better defining that and making sure that there's a level of service that is delivered that would be what we would all expect and want for our elders. I don't want you to get hung up about this. Mm-hmm. I fully support this bill. But I'm also noticing that a lot of it is around workforce, which is important since that's our desperate need right now. And it's around workforce conditions, workforce rates, workforce flow, and all of that. And I just wanted to encourage and maybe even make a line in here that would be mindful of also that piece of standards around what does keep our elders safe and at home. And I imagine you have some ideas around that. So I'm happy to hear them.
Through the co-chair. Thank you. I'll just be brief. I think that I believe that the state has a number of processes in place by which they develop service standards, where they determine what services are covered, how much time. You heard Abigail talking about only having 12 minutes to do laundry and dishes and things. And so I don't believe that that's something necessarily that this board would speak to. I think the angle of the, though it could, because that impacts work, but I think the angle that this board would speak to is the workforce prepared to meet the needs that the state has set? Is the workforce prepared that if one of the things that that a service that's provided is helping somebody with transfers in and out, does the worker know how to use a Hoyer lift, for example? And so I don't know that the board necessarily needs to say this is the standard, but I think the board would point to clearly the workforce is not prepared to meet this need. What are the experts or what is the process for determining what training is needed in order to meet the need?
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Okay. Representative Ballard.
Thank you. So, Co-Chair, I just wanted to state kind of the obvious here. I appreciate it. I do like this. And some of the information I gathered today was because I used my phone to go online quickly. So it wasn't like I wasn't paying attention. I just wanted you to know that because I want accurate information to be able to communicate and bring up the points. I'm just trying to figure out, and I know my colleagues and stuff, we use our phones to be able to bring up the right stuff because we don't always get the bill in front of us for long durations and take up that time. I guess my question is, when you're here representing the union, correct? Am I mistaken on that?
Oh, Ms. correct. Rudich. Alexis, and through the chair, correct. I work for the Service Employees International Union.
Okay. So I guess I'm just curious if you could tell us a little bit why this board or would have any, why would the union be involved? Because if we're trying to form a board, money would go to the union and dues, and I'm just kind of confused. And if you could just explain it to me a little bit more, I can get more understanding. Because if we're going to spend money on this, I want it to go where it should go. Not that I necessarily want a board formed, but we'll figure it out.
Ms. Rudich.
Yes, through the co-chair. So from the moment that the Alaska Caregivers Union was founded nearly 5 years ago now, the vision of our members, and you know, you've seen and met with a number of our members, a number of the caregivers from around the state. I think we had 75 come in from around the state this year, and that is a very small portion of the thousands that we actually work with and represent to varying degrees. This has always been for us and for our members about building a long-term, stable care system for Alaska. That's what we have been invested in. A union is made up of its members, truly. And for our members, they're not invested in having a union for a union's sake. They are invested in ensuring that they have, that there is a care system that they can continue to work, that they continue to provide services for their own clients, that when they retire, they'll have caregivers for themselves. I mentioned the our members that have children with disabilities that want to know that if anything happened to them, there'd be a qualified, trained caregiver to provide those services. And so, of course, we as a union that works with workers want to make sure that there is that we can help them have a voice in shaping what that long-term care system looks like.
Okay. May I just quickly?
Representative.
Okay. So the union is here. That would probably push me away from supporting this bill. I don't think these individuals need a union. I think they're grown up and they could speak on their own behalf. If we're going to develop a commission, it's a little bit, it's just a little bit too much for me. So thank you, Representative Prox. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Do we have any further questions or comments? Representative Jimmy.
We had a co-chair Foster. I just wanted to commend the maker of this bill. It is important, and especially in rural, where elders do not want to leave their communities. I've run into more than one elder who couldn't speak English and would just say, which would mean I want to go home. And also, people who become home health care workers, they end up loving what they do, and having to and being able to provide for family members or other people in the community is very good for them, and they embrace it. I just want to say thank you.
Okay, I've got Representative Hannon. Did you have a? Okay, Representative Tomaszewski.
Yes, thank you. So you, this question is for Ms. Rodich. You said the union was formed 5 years ago. How many members of the caregivers do you currently have from the state of Alaska?
Ms. Rodich.
Sure. Thank you. Sorry, through the chair. So that number fluctuates because this is a workforce that changes pretty frequently for the reasons that we have discussed. There are the two largest care agencies or personal care agencies are unionized. That's Consumer Direct and Always Caring. And so the membership, depending on, again, what's going on with the workforce, ranges between, I want to say between 750 to 850 members right now. On top of that, I'm sure that many of you have met people that are not formal members of the union, but we consider part of our larger caregiver movement. And we think their voice, for example, there are people who take care of children. They're unpaid caregivers that take care of children. And we think that their voice is also very important when we come to Juneau, when they talk to you all about what the care system needs. And so that total number right now would probably be closer to 1,000 to 2,000, like probably a little over 1,000, 1,500.
Thank you. Follow up.
Follow up.
And I'm just curious how many caregivers overall in the state do you know that there are? I know it fluctuates, but is that a large percentage of them? Is it half of them? Or
Ms. Rodich?
Through the chair. So no, it's not half. I think that number also fluctuates. The state actually doesn't require that DSPs, for example, direct support professionals, doesn't need to register with the state. So there's actually no way of knowing exactly how many caregivers there are. The personal care attendants do need to register with the state, but that number isn't, as far as I know, published anywhere, or there's not an exact number. Maybe that's around 4,000. Last time that I saw a number, it'd probably be around 4,000 total PCAs. If you want to speak about unpaid caregivers, AARP said there's about 94,000 of them in the state, which is part of the problem that we're trying to solve.
Okay. So thank you for that. And what is it? What does it cost for a caregiver to be part of the union? Is there monthly dues? Is there a percentage of their paychecks, or what is the cost for them?
Ms. Rodich.
Yes, through the chair. Dues for our members in Alaska are 1.95%.
And that's just 1.95% of their paycheck total?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, next I've got Representative Galvin, then I believe Hannon, and then Josephson. Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Through the chair, I just wanted to commend you again for bringing this forward, and I appreciate that the board is lining up, getting itself organized, and ensuring that all care providers are welcome to the table, whether or not they're unionized. I think that's going to be very helpful for all of Alaska in thinking about the changing of the demographics of Alaska. This is going to save us money, because we know that elders prefer to be at home. And so I know that this is sort of that on-ramp that we get more organized and get, I think, I'll say more efficient about doing it, so that we're sharing tips and making sure that there's some standards there. I appreciate all of that. I want to make sure that those folks who are helping our elders stay at home, where they save tens of thousands of dollars a year, are given some guidelines and also have the opportunity to ensure that they have a great job. So thank you.
Okay. Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. And I guess I wanted to just, I've spoken about my sister previously, who died from complications from MS, that was diagnosed at 20 and at 45 became disabled and had to quit her job. She was a state employee and had in-home care services until her death with caregivers. She had a caregiver for over 10 years. She had the maximum allowed by law number of hours in her home of 37 and a half hours a week of care in her home, but lost that caregiver to become just someone's cleaning lady, because that was easier care. And my sister's care had become more and more complex as her MS had progressed. And I certainly see why most caregivers would need to be unionized or would seek that out, because they generally work in isolation from others. And when we as a policy setting agency have worked to try and get pay increases into the hands of the people who are doing that direct care and service delivery, and then they say, you may have put more money out there through disability services, but it didn't come into their care hands. And as Medicaid rules change, they're not allowed to get reimbursed for gas, yet they still are supposed to do the grocery shopping and cooking, but they're not getting reimbursed for gas. So the complexity of being able to, one, have a steady, trusted relationship with your caregiver becomes more and more fragmented. And the people who would like to do that service, when they're, especially if they're not your family member, they can't, because at the end, the caregivers need to be able to, if it's a job, pay their mortgage and pay for their own groceries. And I think having a union has been able to bring those voices of the wide spectrum of caregivers together and say, we're looking to make sure that our service delivery to the clients is what we as policymakers are saying we want. We want Alaskans to get care and be able to live independently as long as they can. And so I'm very supportive of the bill. We haven't met before, but Representative Prax knows when I'm asking those questions really about composition, it's not – I'm not trying to thwart it. I'm just trying to make sure I understand. And in particular, like the question of a client, I could imagine my sister would have wanted to serve, but I am not sure she would have been able to be the most effective board member as her MS progressed. And generally, I would think that most people with physical disabilities but not cognitive, they got a lot to say, but they struggle to be in a situation to be able to communicate that. And their caregivers develop really good translator skills to understand what they are saying, what they want. So I applaud that as being a position on the board, but see that in many times it's going to probably be a representative of that care recipient, because the nature of them having disabilities are they're not going to be able to be the most active board member. But I appreciate this because it isn't now I'm in that demographic, as you know, legally an elder, and I sure want to be able to stay in my own home and live as independently as possible to the end. But thank you for letting me tell my story.
Okay. And next up I've got Representative Josephson.
Yes. Thank you, through the chair. As I understand this, maybe this goes to Mr. Riley. You have a 10-member board, two are non-voting, and two are representing direct care workers. So it sounds like 2/10 of them would represent the direct care workers, meaning they could be associated with a labor union. Do I have that right? Mm-hmm.
That question was directed to
through the chair,
Mr. Nye.
Yeah, for the record, Riley Nye.
Sorry, apologies, Riley Nye.
Through the chair to Representative Josephson. That is correct. Page 2, line 5, that speaks to that.
Okay. A follow-up?
Follow-up.
For either the sponsor or Mr. Nye, my sense is that you've asked Ms. Rodich, if I've said that right, Rodich, to assist you because, as Representative Hannon alluded, she has expertise in the economies of caretaking and the service delivery of caretaking and the need of caretaking. Is that why you've asked for her assistance?
Mr. Representative Prox.
Through the chair. No. Okay. They brought the bill to me, I think, 3 or 4 years ago.
Okay.
And then, you know, to be honest, I was skeptical. And I checked in with the Medicaid, Medicare regulations, and it's very much drawn off of the federal regulations that were coming down the pike. And that's why there's kind of some obscure terms and definitions and whatnot. But this was pretty much taken off of what we were expected to do to comply with Medicare, Medicaid regulations in the first place.
Follow up. My sense through the chair, Representative Prox, is that, and I think you said as much in your opening, is that your interest is in protecting the purse of the state.
Right.
And it's a utilitarian one. You're trying to generate human happiness and keep people at home and safe. And you, maybe I don't want to put too many words in your mouth, but basically you see that as a win for them and a win for our treasury. Is that a fair statement?
Representative Prox.
Through the chair, I think so. I kind of doubt that we're going to end up spending less total money in the end because the demand for services is growing faster than the supply of services, in fact. But I think the cost per person cared for will go down over time.
Mr. Chairman, I'm remembering when I taught constitutional law, which I did for 5 years, there's a case called Jones versus Lachlan Steele from the New Deal era. It's 1937. And it noted that workers have a fundamental right to organize and bargain. And that isn't what this bill is about. It's sort of ancillary to it. But I think it's important to remember that. When the court says there's a fundamental right, that's sort of important. Right. Thank you.
Representative Prox.
And just another, this is, in the end, an advisory board. There's a lot of formalities to the organization and whatnot, but they send a report to the commissioner who can agree. If the commissioner disagrees, they will say why, and then the whole thing has to be approved by the CMS as well.
Thank you.
Okay. One of two options here. Well, first of all, I'd like to move on to the next bill and make sure we've got enough time to give that a proper introduction. But in terms of where we go from here, I can either set the amendment deadline. I am hearing some interest in this bill. I think a little bit of opposition as well. So I want to make sure that we're providing members an opportunity. If they want to give amendments, we can certainly set that deadline, or if folks want to move it. Am I seeing some interest in wanting to maybe think about some amendments? Is that okay? Yeah. So with that, we're going to go ahead and set amendment deadline for this bill, which is House Bill 96. There is an interest in wanting to think about some amendments, so we're going to give an opportunity for that. Representative Allard.
Thank you. Can I, Co-Chair, I just wanted to ask a question to the sponsor of the bill.
Representative Allard.
Thank you. Representative Prox, is it a possibility that this could be volunteer positions, per se, instead of paid positions, or would you be open to perhaps looking at a reallocation of, for the board, a reallocation of the vacant positions that could possibly be filled through Department of Health to sit on to form this board?
Representative Prox.
Well, absolutely.
I'm more than happy to talk to you. I just
whatever.
Don't want to do something to hurt the bill too. Okay. We could talk. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. So today is Wednesday. What I'd like to do is set an amendment deadline for Monday, April 20th at 5 p.m. That'll give folks 3 full business days to write up amendments. And so if there's nothing else on this bill, Representative Prox, thank you very much for reintroducing us to the bill. Good, robust discussion. And thank you to Mr. Nye and Ms. Rodich. We're going to take a 2-minute break, allow folks to either walk down the hall or grab some coffee here. And then next up, we're going to come back to an introduction, first introduction of Senate Bill 86. That's the money transmission bill. So with that, we're going to take a brief at ease.
They do. No, they don't.
I'm going to call this meeting of the House Finance Committee back to order at 3:01 p.m. And I just wanted to recognize Representative Allard.
Thank you, Co-Chair. So we had our Representative Proxen here a few minutes ago, and after speaking to a few other people during our at ease, I would like to recommend that we go ahead and move that bill out. I can't remember.
Oh, it's Bill 96?
Yes, please. And I think it's because there's the Representative Proxen agreed there were kind of a couple of things that we could work on together to make it, I don't know, better. There's always a way to make bills better, no matter what they are. And so he seemed like he was open to do that. So is it possible, Co-Chair, that we can move that bill out today?
I think so. I just wanted to make sure that Representative Prox didn't have any other things going on and was maybe opposing that, but I don't see a stop. Representative Prox, do you have any comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, this is Representative Mike Prox. I kind of had a nap planned, but this is okay.
Okay. Just wanted to cross our T's and dot right. Our I's.
Yes. Yeah, and if there are questions, please let me know, because we want to make this work as well as we can.
Okay, great. Thank you. So with that, if it is the will of the committee, I would entertain a motion, Representative Shragi.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. I would be happy to make a motion, if I could just find the work order number here in one moment. There we go. Co-Chair Foster, I move House Bill 96, Work Order 34-LS0297/T, with attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
Okay. And if I could just minor, it's a CS for House Bill 96. And if that is okay, then I don't see any objections. And so with that, CS for House Bill 96, which is version 34-LS0297/T, is moved out of House Finance with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. And so with that, thank you so very much, Representative Prox. And if we could sign the committee report, and we're going to jump right into the next bill here. So thank you, Representative Prox.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. And our next bill up is House Bill or Senate Bill 986, and that is the Money Transmission and Virtual Currency Bill. And if we could have Senator Keel, as well as his staff, Ms. Aurora Hawk, please come up to the table and put yourselves on the record and give us an introduction. As we go into questions, we do have a going to shoot to get out of here at our normal time at 3:30. We do have a number of people available for questions, and that is Ms. Tracy Reno, Director of the Division of Banking and Securities. Actually, it looks like she'll be providing invited testimony during the introduction, and then we do have a number of people online also with the Division of Banking. But let's just jump right into the introduction. Thank you, Senator Keel.
Thank you very much, Co-Chair Foster. Thank you, Co-Chairs Josephson and Shragi and members of the House Finance Committee. I appreciate you taking the time to hear Senate Bill 86 today. For your records, my name is Jesse Keel. I have the great privilege of serving as the Senator for District B. And with me today is Aurora Hawk, whom I have the equally great privilege of having work in my office. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 86 modernizes Alaska's money transmission statutes. It updates us from one model to a much more efficient and more modern model. It also explicitly includes cryptocurrencies, what the bill calls virtual currencies. for the committee, in 2007, Alaska passed the Uniform Money Services Act, some very basic safety and soundness rules for money transmitters and currency exchangers. It was put together by what we now call the Uniform Law Commission. They had a longer name back then, and was built to be passed by all 50 states. The feds don't do this, Mr. Chairman. Money transmission is the purview of the states. Unfortunately, we passed that bill in 2007, and it was almost immediately out of date. In 2008, a person, or maybe people, writing under the pseudonym Satoshi Nakamoto, published a paper coming up with the concept of a distributed ledger, non-governmental item of value that could serve as a, well, cryptocurrency. The next year, in 2009, the first Bitcoin software became public, and folks could buy trade cryptocurrency for the first time on Earth. Incidentally, 2009 was the same year that Venmo was created. Mr. Chairman, our 2007 Act was really based around money transmission in what you'd think of as the old-fashioned sense, someone taking money to Western Union and wiring it, sending it to a friend or a relative. In 32nd legislature, the administration submitted a governor's bill to update our money transmission laws. They resubmitted it in the 33rd legislature, and in the 34th legislature, I took on the opportunity to work with the Division of Banking and Securities to bring it back before the legislature, and it is before you today. It updates Alaska's laws to, as I said, a new model. This one put together by the Conference of State Bank Supervisors. These are the folks who regulate banks and money transmitters and similar businesses at the state level from all 50 states, red states, blue states, purple states, working together with industry. They built this model with broad support. it's important, Mr. Chairman, that we do this. The value of both money transmission and of cryptocurrency that we know of is colossal. And when it comes to crypto, the only thing we know is we don't know all of it because it's not regulated now. In the last calendar year, 2025, in Alaska, money transmission, so all of it, whether it's greenbacks or crypto, that we're aware of was valued at $8 billion. It's up 25% from the year before. That's 31,433,000 transactions. That's up 11% from the year before. So divide that by 525,600 minutes that make up a year. You get 6 transmissions a minute. When I presented this bill on the Senate floor, Mr. Chairman, I told them how many transactions my remarks were going to be, and nobody laughed. Bunch of humorless senators. Of the $8 billion that we're aware, 30% of the value was cryptocurrency, $2.3 billion. But that wasn't up a quarter. That was up 53% from the year before. So there is a lot of this value moving around, and Alaska's laws don't fit it very well. And again, Uncle Sam doesn't look at this. So the basic goals of this bill are at their root the same as the 2007 Act. Basic safety and soundness regulation. So the word regulation has lots of meanings to lots of people. This is not what we do with insurance, right? Nobody is going to tell these companies that this is your regulated return on investment. This is not the RCA looking at a utility. This is about making sure there are no crooks in the corporate ladder, no embezzlers, no fraudsters, right? Making sure that when you entrust either your money or your cryptocurrency to a company, they have cash or very safe investments to cover it, or in the case of cryptocurrencies, that they have the coin to cover it while it's either stored with them or in transmission. It's about making sure nobody diverts the customer's assets. You may remember from the news a couple of years ago, the Sam Bankman-Fried prosecutions. It doesn't get to go into your hedge fund when you're telling an Alaskan that it's in their account. It's also about protecting Alaskans' assets from bankruptcies. This is a fast-moving, fast-developing industry. And when things change through mergers and acquisitions, everybody's usually okay. When the company goes bankrupt, Alaskans have to be protected. One of the things that this bill makes crystal clear is that if a company moving or holding cryptocurrency for an Alaskan goes bankrupt, your asset is not part of their bankruptcy. It is yours. Unfortunately, I have to inform the committee that one's actually a change. When folks click on the agree to terms and conditions without reading it, one of the things you may well have agreed to is that they can use your coin to settle their debts. That's not okay. Some other very basic consumer protections in the bill, Mr. Chairman. Timely transmission rules. If you go to send $500 to someone, it has to get there timely. They can't sit on it and earn interest on it for indeterminate amounts of time. You're entitled to receipts. They have to show certain basic things. Have to get disclosure when you're moving money around of exchange rates. And you have to follow your contract. The bill also increases efficiency, I mentioned that earlier, by letting Alaska's banking and securities folks cooperate, collaborate with those from other states. So they can do multi-state exams, and Alaska can accept, can choose to accept, the exams from other state examiners. So I'll just throw out random names by way of illustration. If the time comes to do an examination on Venmo, a money transmitter, and the state of Alaska has no particular concerns, has received no particular complaints, they may work with other states and say, okay, Rhode Island and Alabama are both going on this exam. Great. We'll read the report. We'll make sure it's adequate. But if company X, the state of Alaska has dozens of complaints, we may say we want our examiner on that one. We're sending somebody. Mr. Chairman, some other efficiencies in the bill. It uses an online registry, a national registry, the National Multi-State Licensing System. Yes, this is the same one we use to license mortgage brokers or real estate agents to do the background checks, which will be cheaper, faster, more efficient. You can also use the registry for some of the reporting, which lets it all happen digitally. And it lets the department update their fee structures. The fee structures back in 2007 were based around the notion that the more locations you had, probably the bigger company you were. So if we charge you by location, bigger companies pay a little more, smaller companies pay a little less. That's way out of date today. And so this allows the division to get back to covering the costs of regulating money transmitters and cryptocurrency companies, which they're not quite making today, Mr. Chairman. And to do that with a tiered structure of fees based on, generally speaking, the amount of value covered. A couple of other things worth knowing about the bill, Mr. Chairman, before I hand it over with your permission to the division for their presentation. The bill is built around the notion of a single regulator. We're not looking to double regulate anybody. If in the future your bank starts taking deposits, making loans, doing accruing interest on crypto, they will be regulated under Alaska's bank laws. They won't be regulated twice. However, today, nobody's watching the companies that hold or transmit crypto on behalf of Alaskans. There are no rules on what Alaskan can buy. We don't regulate what risks an Alaskan may choose to take. We just make sure that it doesn't get diverted subjected to fraud or theft. The bill is also based around the lowest barriers to entry that we could. Alaska has a history of mom and pops in the money transmission space. We don't want to close off that opportunity. Certainly the biggest players in this industry are very large indeed. They have floors of corporate lawyers who can do compliance. The part of the goal of going to this Model Act is to make it easy for a new entrant into the field to make it as easy for them as we can. So, Mr. Chairman, those are the principles behind the bill, basic safety and soundness, an Alaska watchdog who can get results for Alaskans, and protecting Alaskans' interest in money transmission and in the cryptocurrency that is transmitted to, from, or within Alaska on Alaskans' behalf. With that, Mr. Chairman, I have staff who can orient members to the sections of the bill. If it's with your permission, I'd like to throw to the Director of Banking and Securities, who has a presentation from the administration.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Keel. What I'm going to do is, we do have somebody online for public testimony. They are in D.C., which means it's 7:15 p.m. there. And I think it's just the one person, so I'd like to go ahead and go straight to public testimony. I'll open public testimony on Senate Bill 86. And if folks would like to submit public testimony via email, they can do so by emailing us at house.finance@akleg.gov. And going to open it up to the person online, but also wanted to say that if folks wanted to submit public testimony via by calling in at a future hearing, then we can certainly do that as well. So with that, Mr. Adam Fleischer, you're calling in from Washington, D.C. If you can state your name and your affiliation and provide your testimony.
Hi. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, everybody. My name is Adam Fleischer. I'm an attorney at the law firm Cooley LLP. I am based in Washington, D.C. I represent a trade group called the Money Services Roundtable, which is made up of some of the largest money transmitters in the country, such as Western Union and MoneyGram. I also, in my practice as an attorney practicing here, represent a large swath of companies across this industry that engage in activities that potentially or certainly trigger state money transmission licensing. And I've worked with a number of companies getting them licensed throughout the country. We appreciate the opportunity to testify in strong support of SB 86. Talk about TMSRT, the trade group that I represent and on whose behalf I am testifying today. Our member companies collectively serve millions of consumers and customers across the United States and in Alaska, provide payments and money transmission services. Our members are committed to robust consumer protection, responsible innovation, and constructive engagement with our state regulators. We have a direct and significant interest in the development of sound, modern money transmission regulation. We have supported this legislation and similar legislation in many states throughout the country. SB 86 would replace the current money transmission law in Alaska with this new regulatory framework based on the Model Money Transmission Act, which was developed by the Conference of State Bank Supervisors. This model law was a product of rigorous, transparent, and a collaborative process among regulators and industry participants and CSBS, with the idea of creating a new model law that could serve as a mechanism to harmonize the regulation of money transmission across states. It does not drastically change how Alaska or most other states regulate money transmission companies today. Rather, it provides a harmonized framework for regulating money transmission companies that both decreases the regulatory burden on the industry, because instead of having to figure out and navigate 50 different laws, companies are able to operate under one, effectively the same law throughout each and every state. And it provides robust customer protection, so it actually has the effect of strengthening the regulation of money transmission companies across the country. So, you know, at the risk of oversimplification, we and I, representing the industry, see it as a win-win, more robust and consistent regulatory framework for consumer protection and financial safety and soundness, and at the same time, reducing the overall aggregate compliance burden on industry participants. The three key elements, or some key elements of this regulation, of this law, are a standardized net worth requirement, the amount of assets in excess of liabilities that licensed money transmitters must maintain based on their size, consistent surety bond requirements so that it is predictable for licensees with respect to how much of a surety bond they must maintain, and uniform definitions of regulated activity and exempt activity, and of things like licensees' permissible investments, which help licensees must help regulators ensure that licensees have sufficient funds to cover outstanding money transmission obligations and ensure that licensees and companies operating in this space operate under consistent definitions and consistent regulatory expectations. So in conclusion, we think that SB 86 represents a meaningful opportunity for Alaska to modernize and harmonize its money transmission regulatory framework with other states in a way that strengthens consumer protection, reduces unnecessary compliance burdens, and promotes efficiency and opportunity for innovation in this space. We are fully committed to working with the division and the legislature to support successful implementation of this legislation. We urge the committee to advance this bill. I thank you for your consideration and welcome any questions you may have.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Do we have any questions for Mr. Fleischer? Okay, seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony, Mr. Fleischer. Do we have anybody else in the room or online who would like to testify? I don't see any, so we'll go ahead and close public testimony. But again, if there is a desire for more testifiers in the future, happy to do that. So I'm going to close public testimony on SB 86. And so with that, we're going to come back to what I'd like to do is I am keeping a list. I do have Representative Stapp on the, in line here so far, and we'll go to invited testimony, the fiscal note, and then we'll come back to questions. So with that, looks like Ms. Tracy Reno, it shows here that you're in the room. Oh, wait, no, I don't see you on the list. Oh, wait, there you are. Looks like you're in Anchorage. If you can state your name and your affiliation and put yourself on the record.
Through the chair, for the record, my name is Tracy Reno. I've been with the Division of Banking and Securities for 14 years, and I've been the director since July of last year. Thank you to the committee for taking time today to hear us bill SB 86, the Money Transmission Modernization Act. The Division of Banking and Securities is responsible for the regulation of financial institutions, financial services, and securities in the state, with the exception of insurance, national banks, and federal credit unions. We oversee over 149,000 licensees, individuals, and registrations, including four state chartered banks, one state chartered credit union, trust companies, mortgage companies, payday lenders, and money transmitters, to name a few. Originally, money transmission was going into a business like Western Union, giving them cash to wire to a family member, and a telegram would be sent off to another office instructing that office to deliver the money. In the 1980s, stored value cards were introduced. You can see these on J-hooks at Fred Meyer or Cars, where you can buy a reloadable Visa card and you pay a cashier to load the money onto the card. Stored value cards are also money transmission. There have been two key developments in money transmission. Now smartphones are nearly universal. The phone in your pocket likely either has Apple Pay or Google Pay embedded in it, which is a mobile payment app that conducts money transmission. As Senator Keel mentioned, the second major development was virtual currency, also commonly called cryptocurrency. Mobile payment applications and cryptocurrency now represent the majority of what money transmission is in Alaska. Neither mobile payment apps nor virtual currency existed when our current act was passed by the legislature in 2007. SB 86 is a generational update to modernize Alaska's money transmission laws to address these technological innovations. This bill is based on a model law drafted in collaboration by the Conference of State Bank Supervisors, state regulators, and the money transmission industry. There are numerous letters of support from money transmission trade groups and the Alaska Bankers Association. What does SB 86 do? It harmonizes Alaska law with 31 states who have adopted the model law in whole or in part. There are currently four states that have legislation introduced this session. SB 86 creates a single set of rules for licensing, examination, and supervision. Having similar laws and as other states keeps Alaska open for business, allows innovation while reducing regulatory burden on industry and the regulator. The bill allows full utilization of the online nationwide multi-state licensing system, or NMLS. One example of efficiencies from fully using the NMLS will be saving hundreds of hours of staff time on manual background checks. These will become automated under SB 86, ensuring bad actors are not running our licensed companies. Division staff conduct examinations to ensure licensees operate in compliance with state and federal laws so that individuals and businesses on sanctions lists do not conduct business in Alaska or in the United States. Examiners verify that licensees run every customer and every transmission recipient through a check of various lists of banned individuals and companies from the Office of Foreign Assets Control, or OFAC, sanctions lists. Examiners also verify that all aspects of the Bank Secrecy Act are complied with, including monitoring and investigating suspicious transactions for structuring, money laundering, and fraud, and reporting suspicious transaction reports, or SARs, to the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network for investigation by law enforcement. This bill also updates record keeping from 3 to 5 years to line up with the Bank Secrecy Act requirements. SB 86 contains a fiscal note. The committee should know first that all funds in the fiscal note are DGF funds. The division's receipts pay for our operations.
The committee should also be aware that the Division of Banking and Securities is self-supporting and had a budget of $5.4 million for fiscal year 2026. Last year, the division contributed over $19 million in revenue to the general fund from licensing receipts, examinations, and civil penalties, and that amount will continue to grow. However, our money transition program area as it exists now does not generate sufficient revenue to cover the cost of supervision. Currently, every licensee pays the same $1,000 renewal fee, whether they transmit $0 in Alaska or over $1 billion in Alaska each year. All of these companies pay the same $1,000. The division intends on changing the fee structure by adopting fee tiers based on a formula of the total amount of money transmitted to, from, or within the state. Please note that there will be no additional cost to consumers. Money transmitters do not charge customers any more or less based on where they live. We are currently considering Ohio and Texas formulas for the fee tiers. The tiered fee model will be designed to cover the cost to regulate the transmission industry and will be the right fit for Alaska small businesses and not a barrier to entry. The regulations creating this tier structure will go out for public comment. The language in this bill was first introduced as a governor's bill in 2022. This is the division's fifth year working to pass this legislation to modernize the act to reduce regulatory burden and enhance consumer protections. Money transmission in Alaska is at an all-time high and shows no signs of slowing down. Currently, there are 187 money transmitters licensed in Alaska, and 39 of those companies transmit virtual currency. In 2025, Alaskans conducted over 31 million transactions worth $7.9 billion. 29% of that, or $2.2 billion, was in virtual currency. Money transmission is a critical part of Alaska's economic engine. Alaskans used it thousands of times during this presentation. The Division of Banking and Securities regulates the movement of money. It doesn't matter what Alaskans send or receive, cash or cryptocurrency. It's our job to ensure money transmitters move Alaskans' money where and when it's supposed to. Thank you, Senator Keel, for sponsoring this bill. I'd like to thank each committee member for your time today. I'm available to answer any questions you may have, and I have senior staff on the line. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much, Ms. Reno. I would like to just check the box real quickly and go through the fiscal note here. And for that, looks like we have Ms. Autumn Miller, Acting Chief of Examinations. Ms. Miller, if you could just walk us through the fiscal note and maybe tell us what control code you have at the bottom right of your paper is.
Through the chair, this is Autumn Miller, Acting Chief of Examinations. I don't have that. I believe Director Tracy Reno does.
Ms. Tracy Reno, is that who's going to be walking us through that? Is that correct?
Through the chair, Tracy Reno, Director, Division of Banking and Securities. We do have a fiscal note. For the first year, $579,000 will be for three positions. And in the second year, will be a total of $902,500. Again, adding new positions will be two in the second year, three in the first year. And then along with that are also services and, you know, one-time setup costs for equipment and space and training.
Okay. And just to confirm, is the control code on your fiscal note CDBAS? And
I believe that is correct.
Okay. I think that's what we all have. So we are at the end of our time. I did have two people ask questions. And so I'm going to take those up. And then, unfortunately, we're going to have to pick this up again. So the two folks I have in line here are Representative Stapp and Galvin. Representative Stapp.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair, to Senator Keel and staff. Thank you guys for being here. Always a pleasure to have a illustrious senator in our House Finance Committee. So just practical example. I think I'm obviously tracking the technical details of this bill. I'm going to give you a practical example and tell me how this works in the event this thing happens in our state after this bill becomes law. So the FTX thing with Sam Bankman-Fried, you had brought up that they basically used their investors' deposits to try to pay off their debts, and this bill would prevent that. So let's say we pass this bill next year. We have a Sam Bankman-Fried, and he's got a different company in Alaska, and the same thing happens again. What happens in terms of regulatory compliance and stuff like that with this bill through the chair?
Thank you. Mr. Co-Chairman, in answer to Representative Stapp, the bill is designed to prevent it from happening in the first place. So the new FTZ by Mr. Bankman-Fried is going to need to have a minimum net worth. It's going to need to have, to the extent they are transmitting cash for Alaska, it's going to need to have cash or very safe investments, and those are lined out in the bill with some flexibility for the department. And it's going to need to actually hold the coin for cryptocurrency, for virtual currencies, that Alaskans have entrusted to it, and they will be subject to, as you heard the director say, examinations by the bank examiner periodically, who actually goes through the books and makes sure it's really there. It's not off in the hedge fund or pledged as a collateral for some loan somewhere.
Fault, Mr. Co-Chair.
Follow up.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair. To Senator Keel. Thanks. So basically, Kent, on this bill, when I've been asked about it, which is very rarely, I know that's probably disappointing. It's not the number one issue in the state, you know. But I just tell folks, hey, like, it's just designed to make sure what happened with Sam Bankman-Fried and the FTX doesn't happen here to you in Alaska. It's a consumer protection bill. We want to make sure nobody's out there stealing your money in a big Ponzi scheme. You think that's fair? Through the chair, Senator.
Senator Keel.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, to respond to Representative Stapp, I do think that's a fair characterization of the most important part of the bill. It also, by having an Alaska regulator, provides some opportunities potentially to get in the middle if they're notified quickly of scam, of fraudulent transactions. It imposes some requirements on the companies. They need to follow the Bank Secrecy Act, the Know Your Customer provisions. And so there are provisions you will see, they mirror Alaska existing law, that if they believe the law is being broken, they can't complete the transaction. They need to hold and notify. To be clear, Mr. Chairman, that's only when they suspect a crime. This does not get the state involved generally in looking into your books or your crypto wallet. That only applies when some of those criminal laws come into effect.
Great.
Thanks.
Okay. I've got two people online, but I'm going to go ahead and adjourn, and we'll pick up with questions at our next meeting. And those two people are Representative Galvin and Representative Allard. And then Representative Bynum. So with that, Senator Keel, thank you so very much for introducing the bill. Our next meeting is scheduled for tomorrow morning. That's Thursday, April 16th, and that's going to be at 9 a.m. And at that meeting, we'll introduce a CS for House Bill 193. That's the paid parental leave bill. House floor. Oh, wait. I don't think this is correct. If we have House floor tomorrow at 9:30, I don't think we can be here at 9 when folks will be in caucus. Am I missing Representative or Mr. Brody Anderson? Let's at ease. Okay, House Finance back on record at 3:35 p.m. I think the short of this is we do have a 9 a.m. meeting scheduled for tomorrow. However, there can be other happenings, and so we will for sure be delayed to the call of the chair. We will not gavel in at 9 a.m. It will just be a delay to a call of the chairs tomorrow at 9 a.m. So with that, if there's nothing else to come before the committee, we'll be adjourned at 3:35 p.m. Thank you.